Serenbe is a place where the innate connections humans have with nature and all living things is celebrated through work and play. And we're here to tell the stories of those who have been inspired by this biophilic way of life in our community and across the country. This is Serenbe Stories. Deandra Marisette stopped through Serenbe in December 2019 while on a road trip from New York to her family's home in Texas. She found us while searching for farm stays she could visit along the way and was drawn in by Serenbe's design intention. Her afternoon here made an impression, and her subsequent work on an intersectional environmentalism has made an impression on us. Deandra is a founding member of Intersectional Environmentalist, a platform with the goal to dismantle systems of oppression in the environmental movement. The founding group created a council of environmental activists and sustainability advocates that are committed to identifying ways in which injustices happening to marginalized communities and the earth are interconnected. In this episode, we talk with Deandra about her background in fashion, most recently at Kate Spade, and how that led to climate and environmental activism.
But first, Serenbe Stories is brought to you by The Inn at Serenbe. The Inn is nestled in the rolling countryside of bucolic Serenbe, where guests can walk on the 15 miles of trails through preserved forest land, the wildflower meadow, and the animal village. You can relax by the pool, hot tub, or in rocking chairs on the wraparound porch. Play on the croquet lawn, swings, and in-ground trampolines. Connect with nature and each other, all while staying in luxurious rooms on the inn grounds or within the community of Serenbe. Book your stay today at serenbeinn.com.
I want to welcome everybody back to Serenbe Stories. Today we have a special guest, Deandra Marisette, who is a conscious curator, brand strategist, writer, and founding member of Intersectional Environmentalist. Previously worked at Kate Spade on the apparel buying team, shifted her work to really look at sustainability, but also through the lens of fashion, social impact, and culture. She's doing digital downloads and educational experiences online to help people explore sustainability, the issues that impact people and the planet. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Good morning, everybody.
How are you? Where are you coming to us from today? Are you in Texas?
Yes, I am calling from Texas. I've been bouncing around a little bit lately, but yeah, just really enjoying some warmer weather coming from Manhattan the past few years. So enjoying this warmer winter.
Definitely, definitely. You recently moved back to Texas. You were in New York for a few years, right? Mm-hmm. But you grew up in Texas. Is that right?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Texas, and I had started my career in Manhattan, actually, and then recently made the move back. And I chose to come back via road trip because yeah. I have a very large dog and his name is Buster. He's a chocolate lab. And I could not bear the thought of putting him in the airplane. You know, I just thought that would be so stressful for his poor little heart. So I decided to come home via road trip. And on that road trip, I actually visited Serenbe for the first time.
That's right. So this was this year, but sort of in the winter time, I think, right? In the spring winter. So tell us your Serenbe story. We ask all of our guests, how did you choose to drive through and how did you find us?
Yeah, I was kind of just moseying around online as I was planning my trip. I definitely love to have a well thought out, robust itinerary. So I just did a little bit of research, really trying to figure out how I can appreciate more nature. And I visited a lot of farms and I visited just a lot of really great parks along the way. And I was trying to appreciate just more domestic travel here in the US. I think that after college, I kind of got sucked into the glamorization of traveling abroad. And I visited Europe a lot and I visited Asia. And it just seemed like a really nice time to connect more deeply with, you know, this land that we're on here. So yeah, I found Serenbe online. I thought that the design intention that went into Serenbe and all that it is and all that it represents was really interesting. So I wanted to make sure to pop in and say hello.
And how long was that road trip?
Oh, that road trip was, I want to say it was close to eight days. But mostly because I built in a lot of, you know, farm stays, which was really nice.
That's fun. That's great.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Where else did you find yourself?
I went to Wild Hope Farm, which was great. Loved that. And then otherwise kind of just stopped along the way at various, you know, parks and point views that were really great. But yeah, I would say that that farm stay and then visiting Serenbe were like my two big stops that were the most exciting.
And did you stay at the inn when you were here?
I didn't know. I ended up doing a little bit of a day tour. Monica actually took me on it and it was great. And then there was Monica and who else was it that was there? She was so sweet.
Denise maybe or Millie?
Yes, I think it was Denise actually.
Yeah, Denise is amazing. Yeah.
So sweet. Yeah, so just so welcoming, so great, such an educational day, which was really exciting. So yeah, thank you again for that. That was wonderful.
Yeah, there's a cute picture, I think, on Instagram of you in our animal village, which...
Yes, love the animal village. So exciting. Every time I see goats, I just freak out. So
yes, well, and we used to have some llamas. I mean, they're all really just, you know, pets, I guess is the way to say it. But now there's a couple... What are the steers, Steve? The baby steers or the mini steers?
They're miniature steers and they have a hump on their back. I forget what their actual breed is.
But they just had a baby.
Oh, so, I love that.
So tell us a little bit. So Texas, and I think you were at Texas A&M. So you grew up there, went to college there. Tell us a little bit about how your younger years were inspired to get into environmentalism.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. So growing up in Texas, I can, you know, very candidly say that I didn't have a lot of environmental oriented mentors in my life. can't say that I had too many people to look up to on that regard. I think, you know, as kids, we are all so primed to have such a love for the planet and animals. And you kind of grow up watching all those shows about endangered animals. And then you grow up a little bit and life takes over. We've got like sports and proms and things like that. And those, I guess those things that were taught as kids just tend to drop off a little bit. But for me, they just never did. I was always so passionate and I wanted to figure out, you know, I knew that there were different parts of the country and the world that honed in on environmentalism to such a beautiful degree. And that I just didn't feel I had access to that. Mm-hmm. So I did what I could to find it, right? Find my place in the environmental movement, even if I wasn't consciously thinking of it that way at such a young age. And I ended up going to A&M, where I spent at least 1 year on the ocean campus. And there I work with the Texas Marine Mammal Stranding Network, where I helped to rehabilitate dolphins, which was really nice, and learn a little bit more about that. And just explore the ocean space a little bit more, which was fascinating, until I found my way to business school, where I started honing in more so on marketing and fashion and retail, and kind of just started really exploring consumerism, which felt just so unrelated at the time. But eventually, you know, I found myself in a place where they felt deeply connected. And my journey has kind of come full circle since then.
Yeah. And you then ended up in New York. Had you, I thought I listened to a podcast, you did an internship maybe in New York during college. Is that correct? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So my first taste of New York was me just hopping on a plane, going by myself. My family was very scared. They were like, what are you doing? I went and did an internship there. I actually ended up living really like right by the Empire State Building, which at the time sounded so glamorous and cool. And now that I've spent some time there, I'm like, oh gosh, that is not where you want to be.
Yeah, you're like, it's not really neighborhoody.
No, it wasn't. But it was such a beautiful learning experience. And that was my first taste of my internship was with Ross. And that was kind of my first taste of like the low price retail sector. And of course, you know, that sector builds in a lot of really great points of accessibility, but I also had an opportunity to unpack a lot of the environmental implications of those models. And that was a really eye-opening moment for me. And I think that the first part of my career where I really started to connect what was happening with the environmental movement and mass consumption.
Yeah, it is interesting. I think I worked for Old Navy for a number of years at the Gap in San Francisco, and this is back in the early 2000s, and it was just never discussed. Maybe there were conversations about how people were treated in factories overseas, but the sort of life cycle and sort of where, like, you know, sort of
what that carbon life cycle is for the product, you know, that like sort of a Patagonia or some of these other products now, just wasn't even in the vernacular. We just didn't even talk about it.
Yeah, I think that one of the things we've seen shifting a lot in the environmental movement, or I'm sorry, in the fashion space with regards to the environmental movement, mm-hmm. is that there has been this huge siloing of chit chat about the environment, but then important discussions about fair trade labor rights and things like that. But there haven't been a lot of people really successfully combining the two conversations. And I think that that's what we're really starting to see now. So when we think about mass consumption, are we thinking about where all of the clothes that we throw, I'm throwing up some big air quotes right now. Where do these clothes go when we throw them away? What does that mean? Where do they go? And what are the environmental implications of all of this waste that we're producing? So yeah, I think that there's a lot of opportunity to really combine those conversations, and that's kind of what we're trying to do through our work now.
Yeah. So before we get to what you're up to now, I know that you ended up going to Kate Spade. Yeah. And I know you sort of struggled a little bit, like continuing on the path of sort of this, you know, Kate's not a total mass market retail, but still, it's a pretty huge brand.
Yeah.
But they did have sort of a secret social impact that I didn't know they even had. Can you tell us a little bit about your time at Kate Spade and what that social impact was and how that sort of informed you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I had started really deep diving into sustainability just as I was applying for Kate Spade. I was kind of like in the interview process, and I felt the process was going really well, but I was a little bit at odds. Like, I was like, do I take this job at Kate Spade while I'm learning how horrible the fashion industry is? But I think that there were a lot of elements at play with regards to why I really wanted to get into the industry and learn more. So I think that apparel specifically was an opportunity for me that I was really interested in, because one, obviously mass consumption was something I wanted to learn more about. But then two, there is such a beautiful cultural element to the art of fashion and adornment. And I think that that was something I really wanted to just sit with for a moment. And so when I entered the world of Kate Spade, it was such a beautiful time for me to explore just unabashed femininity, I think. Right. And that is definitely not something I feel I have personally done a good job of embracing. But also just not, I would say even just aesthetically, anybody who's listening and, you know, has Kate Spade imagery in their head, I wouldn't say that I, from a personal style standpoint, identify with that aesthetic at all. So it was just interesting to kind of be an outsider looking in on that style. Yep. So that was great. But then additionally, they also had this internal initiative called On Purpose. Mm-hmm. Which I don't think by any means is a perfect initiative, but it was just interesting to learn about. It basically, if a few years back, I want to say it was five or six years ago, the On Purpose label was created. It was kind of like a label within a label. Mm-hmm. And it was created so that Kate Spade could essentially test a more ethical relationship with a factory that really supported the I would say financial well-being, the mental health well-being, just like a more holistic approach to what it means to have an ethical partnership overseas. And so they found this beautiful community in Misara, Rwanda, which had experienced over the past decades just terrible genocides, and were seeking, you know, forms of recovery. And there's all of this beautiful culture there around artistry. And I think that the label was really able to harness that really well in a way that translated to small leather goods or small bags with just like beautiful forms of embroidery, et cetera. So that was great. But I think that it was eye-opening for me to just understand the notion of social enterprise and really what that means in a fashion landscape. So I think that, for me, it was just really eye-opening to get to watch how this huge retailer, as you said, they're not the biggest, but they're, you know, big enough.
Yeah.
And I think that big retailer, large brand, and we assume that there are just so many barriers to ethics. Mm-hmm. And I mean, totally true. That's definitely a real thing. But yeah, it was just interesting to watch the ways that really passionate folks within the walls of a larger brand. We're fighting to test these concepts just to see what we can make happen. So yeah, I really enjoyed that experience.
Yeah, it's a toughie, right? Because I think there's become so much more awareness over the years about, you know, how can you do well and do good? Because if we don't make money, we can't keep up the enterprise. But you can't, well, I shouldn't say you can't, because a lot of people do. But I think we believe at Serenbe, like the money isn't the end all be all. I mean, you have to do it to keep going. We need to sell houses, but there's like a higher purpose that sort of pushes us forward. Mm-hmm. And so, and like the B Corp. And so how do you find that balance? You know, and I think sometimes in these large corporations, having come from some of them, you know, and especially Kate Spade, you know, who's not with us any longer, but, you know, she probably had a passion and wanted to do good, but she already had created this conglomerate. Mm-hmm. And so how do you push that through as a passion project? Does it fit into this corporate, and I'm using the air quotes now, jigsaw puzzle that's already off and running, you know? And Steve, I was telling Deandra earlier about Ray Anderson. And I think that that's an interesting story of how he has really turned Interface, or he's no longer with us as well, but he was really a mentor of yours, Steve, and how he really turned Interface to be go carbon neutral. But I'm not sure if you can think about his struggles that he had as that was sort of beginning.
Well, the overall on this subject is, you know, the only true sustainable or environment sustainable method is when it is for profit. But our problem is we've gotten to where profit is the lead rather than a piece of the entire thing. And, you know, that's certainly when when Ray realized that the carpet industry was one of the huge polluters after reading Paul Hawkins' book, it wasn't to become a nonprofit carpet company. It was how to become a sustainable for-profit company. And so I think that's a lot of times where people get mixed up. Many times when we talk about Serenbe, people think that it is, because it's environmental, it is at a sacrifice to profit, and that's not the case. You know, when the Urban Land Institute a few years ago asked me to address their convention in Dallas, the topic was, what is the premium to do an environmental development? So that's just the automatic assumption that it costs you more. And of course, my whole presentation was the dollar savings environmentally. And so that's, I think, what we really have to change the attitude, because people think they have to sacrifice rather than enhance.
Yeah, I think that that's such a good point. And one of the things that we are exploring with so many incredible people in our community right now is just the notion of people, planet, profit, and what that really means. And it's really difficult to, I think, get that balance right when you're coming from a lens that has been, when your lens is educated in the current capitalistic system that we exist in. It's really hard to kind of untrain your brain. As you said, there's a lot of assumptions going in around what it means to be sustainable. But one of my favorite things to do with regards to that conversation is really look back to, you know, ancient empires that were building massive, incredible, sustainable civilizations based on the notion of resourcefulness. And I think that you kind of just got that wheel turning in my brain. But yeah, that's one of the things that I really love exploring, is just really understanding how BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities have historically been the blueprint for sustainability, and how harnessing that today can build a balanced model between people, profit, and planet.
What was one of the civilizations that you remember that was most interesting?
I think that, well, I might be a little bit biased. coming from my Mexican background, but I will say that one of the, you know, studying the Aztecs, who, you know, had their own problems and issues with, you know, civilization and culture, they still just had a really interesting take on agrarian urbanism. And I think that just like a really resource efficient culture that was highly productive from an agricultural standpoint, that recycled tons of nutrients from their wastes. And I think that when the Spanish came to colonize the Aztecs, they were so impressed with the way that the Aztecs had built their civilization and their framework. And I'm still unpacking why this happened, but in the midst of colonization, they actually ended up dismantling a lot of that framework. And Mexico City, even today, really suffers as a result of colonization, kind of coming in and imposing their own thoughts about the way that infrastructure needs to work from a sustainability standpoint. So I'm still unpacking so much of that, but I just think it's so incredible to learn about how just taking a step back to look at our ancestors and our culture can inform so much of the progress that can be made today.
Well, it's probably going on right today in our food systems. You look at how efficient, and it was better for the soils and the food we ate 100 years ago, 80 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we've totally destroyed that agrarian economy, the economy of it, the healthy food, and we're destroying the soils. So you can easily see how it happened. We think efficiency is the answer, and it actually destroys them. So much.
Yeah, 100%. I recently read, I don't know if y'all have read this book, but I recently finished reading Braiding Sweetgrass. And just such a beautiful book that talked a lot about the way that Indigenous communities really view their relationship with the planet and how science has done us a little bit of a disservice, really ignoring that relationship. And I think that for me, what I took away from not only that book, but a lot of the studies that I've been doing over the past few years is that when we don't bring Black, Indigenous, and people of color communities and just the wisdom that comes with that ancestry to the forefront of environmental conversations, of sustainable design conversations, when we lose the cultural element, we lose beautiful ways of looking at the world. And I think that that's why we are largely in the mess that we're in.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. In fact, you might enjoy, if you haven't read it, there's a woman, Julia Watson, who is a British kind of activist and academic. And she, I think her book is called Low Tech, and it's all about Indigenous technologies. She started out her time studying in Borneo and talking about living bridges and the technologies, these engineers, right? These people who still are there, part of the culture, that know how to make these living bridges and how, I know, right? And maybe that doesn't work at Serenbe, right? Although we do have some cool bridges that are sort of living. Sure. You know, the technology that I do agree, colonialism and industrialization, you know, we're all about progress. We're all about forward. And really, sometimes we need to look backwards. We always say look to nature.
Yeah.
Solutions.
No.
But and it's called Braiding Sweetgrass. I'm going to look that one up too.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. It honestly isn't that long of a read either, but just really eye-opening. And just as a spoiler, you'll never look at a strawberry the same way after you read that.
Okay. Okay, good.
So beautiful. But yeah, Steve, I think you hit it on the head too with regards to kind of summing up our perception today and our point of view being very efficiency driven. And one of the things that I like that book touches on is, as opposed to viewing our progress as through the lens of efficiency, it's more so through the lens of reciprocity. And I think that's really beautiful. So highly recommend that book.
Great. Good. So that leads us sort of perfectly into COVID hits your home. You finished your road trip.
Yes.
And how does sort of this movement that you or the journey you're on with a couple co-founders called Intersectional Environmentalist, I can't even say it, Intersectional Environmentalist.
It's a mouthful.
How does it happen? How does it come together? Obviously, this has been a huge year to sort of rethink everything and how we do everything. But tell me how this came about.
For sure. So I came home from my road trip, and I guess just to shed some light on that road trip, I had decided to quit my job at Kate Spade. I really needed some time to really assess just my relationship with not only fashion, but just consumption in general. And I think that in a larger scope, capitalism. And so I quit my job, was very privileged in that I have a lovely home to come back to with my family here in Texas. And so I road tripped back home. And I think that my intention initially was to just take a beat and go back to New York, but then quarantine hit. So we were kind of stuck here in Texas for a moment, which ultimately ended up being, you know, I suppose a good thing for everything, for the things to follow. So I was home, I was here, and then the resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement happened after the murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and many others. And so I found myself visiting friends, you know, as safely as possible in Austin, Texas. And during that time, while we were there and we were protesting and just trying to wrap our heads around everything that was going on, our founder, Leah Thomas, experienced a really interesting session of virality, if you will. She had posted on Instagram about her views on intersectional environmentalism and really what that means to her, which we can definitely get into. But I guess just to expand on the virality, when we came back, I remember we came back to one of my co-founders' houses, not my co-founder at the time, but one of my co-founders' houses, and we got on the phone with her really just to congratulate her on not only the virality, but just the language that we saw was equipping something that we thought was budding, something that we thought was shifting the narrative a little bit. And it just felt really important. And on that same phone call, we decided to build a website of resources that somewhat mimicked a blog that I had prior to that, just, you know, people to follow, things to read, things to watch. And we had no idea what was going to come of that. We built this little website in a week thinking that maybe it would just help our own communities that we had kind of been operating within, host some really powerful conversations. You know, we definitely live in a beautiful ecosystem where we in the past would just enjoy each other's blogs and each other's posts. And we were a very small little network. And then through that website and the virality of Leah's post, we launched the platform to coincide with the website, of course, Intersectional Environmentalist. And it just really took off in a way that we did not anticipate at all.
It's incredible. Yeah. Absolutely incredible. So tell me a little bit about, for people who don't understand or sort of aren't familiar with the term, yeah. Intersectional is was it Kimberly Crenshaw that sort of popularize that?
Yeah. So I'll definitely give the rundown. So just intersectionality as just a single term was inspired by a group called the Combahee River Collective, which was a Boston-based group of Black feminist lesbians who formed in the 70s to really address how they were being left out of both the feminist and the civil rights movement. And in describing how they experienced multiple overlapping types of oppression, they believed that, you know, I think that their one of their most powerful messages was that if Black women were free, that it would mean that everyone else would have to be free, since their freedom would combat discrimination based on race, class, gender, sexuality. So really highlighting those overlapping identities. Mm-hmm. And their work would later go on to inspire Kimberly Crenshaw, who is a professor of law at Columbia University and the University of California, to coin the term intersectionality in 1989. Okay. And in the past decades, this theory has really expanded to include the experiences of immigrants, folks with disabilities, and those whose lives are impacted by multiple forms of discrimination. And through an intersectional analysis, activists today are learning how to build more inclusive movements and amplify the voices of those who have traditionally gone unheard. So later during my I guess, during the founding of my company, just before that, when Leah went viral, her post included the way she applied this to environmentalism. So she described intersectional environmentalism as an inclusive version of environmentalism that advocates for both the protection of people and the planet. And I think that we hear that a lot. We hear people on the planet, people on the planet. But historically, people haven't been such great advocates of people. So really specifying that it identifies the ways in which injustices happening to marginalized communities and the earth are deeply interconnected. And it brings those injustices done to the most vulnerable communities and the earth to the forefront of the conversation, and does not minimize or silence social inequality, and really advocates for justice for people on the planet.
It was beautiful.
Thank you. And Leah's words.
Well, both of you. It was fantastic. I think that even hearing climate, adding climate, mm-hmm. or sorry, adding justice to climate or adding crisis to climate, I think has been very, very impactful mm-hmm. this year, if not prior, but really coming into sort of more of the nomenclature of the culture this year, mm-hmm. And really understanding the ethics of mm-hmm. climate activism.
Right.
And I know, Steve and I talk about it, if for those listening, you'll both know that we're both white, but, it's been kind of a male white dominated world, and that's kind of obviously many things. And so we have worked really hard with a biophilic institute that we're both on the board and Steve chairs, of how do we bring, women in? How do we bring BIPOC in? How do we bring students in? That it isn't just a, sort of, the senior, white men. And it's a challenge sometimes. But what we found is everybody's out there. You just have to look really hard, and you have to expand your network. So I think your group is an amazing place that we'll be looking to more and more to pull people in to have those conversations. Tell me, so this happened in sort of the late spring, summer?
This launched in July.
July. Oh my God. It was like yesterday.
No, I know. It really has just been so fast.
So fast. Tell me, you guys are kind of, growing it in public, if you will, right? Which is a really beautiful but kind of vulnerable way to grow a business. Mm-hmm. Tell me about, the four of you and what's going on and what are your goals? And I'm sure those are shifting, here and there, but like, what's the core of the movement and that you want to share?
Yeah. So I think that when we first launched the platform, as I mentioned, we didn't know it would be so, widespread. We thought it was just going to be within our community. But I think that regardless, the main goal was to amplify unheard voices. One of the ways that we decided to format the website across different topics and communities was really to highlight work that has been done in the past. I think that for folks who come from more privileged places and just have never really had to unpack any of these issues, mm-hmm. it felt like a new conversation. So it was really important for us to highlight that this conversation has been happening for forever, and that this is not a new conversation, that some folks have just been privileged enough to not have to entertain them. So yeah. It was really important to us to build kind of this resource hub that would really amplify and highlight the work of folks who have been unpacking these difficult topics and difficult conversations for such a long time in a way that is really deeply rooted in the way that BIPOC communities have engined sustainability. And so, yeah, I think that was kind of the starting point. And now a lot of the things that we're testing and building are really rooted in that, just amplifying unheard voices.
Mm-hmm. Which is amazing. And Kimberly Crenshaw, who also has a podcast, which is amazing, yes. for our listeners to totally look at that.
Intersectionality Matters.
Mm-hmm. Yes. She's an amazing voice and curates incredible people yes. that, and I think your point of sort of a new conversation, right? because everybody comes into it at a different place in their lives, right? Mm. And I know, Steve, you know, I was always sort of fascinated. I grew up in the 70s in Los Angeles, and, you know, was just like your typical kind of suburban kid. It didn't really think about sustainability. Like, we recycled, my mom macrame'd, you know, whatever, but nothing much. You know, and Steve, you know, brings up that they were very conscious and had like the first Prius, and, you know, they were doing a lot of the work that, you know, nobody was thinking about. And that kind of crew, Steve, that you sort of knew here and still are friends with in Atlanta, you know, not that you were sort of laughed at, but, you know, people were sort of like, it was sort of silly or sort of extra, right, Steve, that, you know, you were like, oh, Steve's what's this tree hugger idea you have, and how it's become mainstream now. Can you talk a little bit about that, Steve?
Well, it's what we talked about earlier. Everyone presumed that it was a premium to do something environmental, and you were only doing it because it was a passion. It had nothing to do with protecting the earth. It had, you know, people really didn't believe it back then. And and I can thank Ray Anderson, because even before he talked me into doing CeraVe, we had started the bed and breakfast in some of our outlying buildings, and so he entertained there. So I got to meet all the real voices of the 90s that were in that environmental movement, and it was relatively small, which is the amazing part. And Ray formed what he called the Eco Mafia. And it was simply when some key person was visiting Atlanta, there were a group of us he would call and say, let's have lunch. And it was a very informal, and there were only 12. I mean, if we had 14 at a lunch, it was a big it was a big deal. That's how small the movement was, and so it was common sense. But yeah, it was. And when we started CeraVe, I realized that I needed to drop the word environmental community, because people thought I was building straw bale houses and solar, and I realized at that point that if we were going to change the financial markets, I needed to just build a great place that had all the environmental components. And that's what we did, and that has changed attitudes in a lot of diverse industries, because the people move here just because it's a great place, and then they learn about recycling, the importance of solar reduced energy demand and all those things, and then they can take those into their various industries.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that one of the things that, you know, there are so many great initiatives like that happening right now. And like, I love I don't know if y'all are on TikTok, but there's like this trending hashtag that's like cancel lawns.
Like, yay!
Cancel lawns. And I think that that's so beautiful. And I love to see all of these different initiatives kind of coming together. And for me, what I hope to be able to continue to do, like through our work, is to really make sure that as we go uncovering these really beautiful solutions that can inform the way that we choose to live moving forward and the way that we want to progress, is that we're simultaneously unpacking why certain communities don't get to live that way. Yeah. And really making sure that we're building in modes of accessibility as we're creating these things and testing new concepts. And I think that that's really, you know, the flip side of the conversation that hasn't been had enough.
No, and one of the big issues in there that bugs me is affordable housing. You know, everyone mm-hmm. talks about affordable housing, yet we don't talk about the reduced energy demand. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's a crime to do a affordable house that has a power bill, because it doesn't have to be today. The technology is there, whether it's geothermal or solar, for a very small premium, that should be added in, because then it's true affordable housing.
Yeah, right. That's like a more like, how can we look more holistically at what we're offering and deeming accessible?
That's right. And they should all have gardens. I mean, every person graduating from school should know how to grow and prepare their own food. And every affordable housing community should have a farm within it.
Oh my gosh. Criticizing the education system is just a whole nother episode, Steve.
We'll have to have you back for that one. One of the things that I think, you know, is wonderful is that you've talked about a little bit is language and building community around that language. Can you talk a little bit about that, of like what you guys are doing? Because I think intersectionality is such a wonderful word, and it's, if you will, a new word, and sometimes the old words get co-opted. Can you talk a little bit about that concept?
Yeah. So, you know, using the term sustainability, you know, over the past few years has brought me personally so much, but I think that the way that it was heavily co-opted before my discovery of it or a personal adoption of it really brought me into still a very educational space, but one that was, you know, very white led. I understood sustainability and visually associated that language to be, you know, white women in beige clothes with trash in a jar. And, you know, I think that that's all fine and well, but I think that the reason why, you know, language in the process of being co-opted, and what I mean by that for folks listening is, in this context specifically, at least for me, it's more so about a harmful, whether intentional or not, a harmful level of erasure that really deroots the word. And so I think that sustainability, while it brought me so much good, it didn't bring me to a place where I could understand my own identity within the sustainable movement because of how it had been co-opted by a white-led narrative. Mm-hmm. So finding intersectional environmentalism really meant getting to the root of what sustainability is and really learning that BIPOC communities are the blueprint for sustainability. And so I think that, you know, there may come a time where intersectional environmentalism gets co-opted and shifted and moved, but language is incredibly fluid. And I think it's important for us to be open to evolving and understanding both why we need new words and new language to get behind, but also what the heck happened to the last word and how can we avoid that in the future? So yeah, sustainability will still very much so be a part of my language, a part of the words that I use, but categorically, it's just been, you know, kind of shifted and shown in new lights that for me aren't building the most inclusive movement.
Yeah, well, and I think not to dig into politics particularly, but just to talk about, you know, Republican and Democrat, if you talked about environmentalism, you know, over the past, you know, 30 plus years, it became this sort of liberal Democrat. You know, it became political versus a policy initiative. And it's so unfortunate because we've lost so much time. And it's really not, it shouldn't be political. It's a human initiative, right? And so how can we bring it back to that? And I think what you're doing, you know, helps bring us back to thinking about the environment as, you know, there's policies we can have around it. It's not a political divide. It should be, you know, everywhere we're going, it's, you know, what if it was the new, you know, this isn't new, but that, you know, new moonshot, you know, you know, we should all be together moving forward together, towards, you know, restoring, the planet and sequestering.
100%. I agree. And I think that it's important to even note that there are plenty of, you know, super liberal environmentalists that are like, why are you talking about race in a topic or in a conversation around environmentalism? And some folks just really don't want to understand how deeply connected they are and how deeply they inform each other. And so I think that that's, you know, I for conservative folks or conservative groups that think that we're all over here in la la land, I would say that for a long time, BIPOC in a liberal like community or a liberal setting have had to fight for their identity and their voices within a liberal environmental movement as well. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't pat the liberal movement on the back either for being particularly inclusive.
I think that's a fantastically great point. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, back to the whole idea of the new conversation where you've come in is if you don't you know, it's up to each individual to be curious and ask questions and educate themselves.
Yeah.
And it's okay if you didn't know, and it's okay that maybe you were on the wrong side or didn't understand, because mm-hmm. it's all about going forward and how we can, shaming people and canceling them some people maybe need to be canceled, but like really, that's not the best solution, you know? Yeah. It's really about how do we bring, not in a la-la, bring people together just sure. to bring them together, but truly to have a conversation.
Yeah.
You know, like, why do you feel this way? And why do you not realize? And, you know, and I think, cities are really interesting when we talk about, you know, biophilia. You know, Serenby's set in the country here with nature, but it has sort of a city feel, right? The way that it's laid out. Mm-hmm. But big cities, quote unquote, Atlanta's, the New York's, there are so many things that can be done. And one of our favorites is green infrastructure, which just sounds so boring and wonky. But like, what if you brought green infrastructure, you know, sort of back into cities? Where you daylighted your stormwater, and now these sort of creeks that were hidden are back, and we have green back into the city. Mm-hmm. So everybody can enjoy it. And it's not, oh, I have a view because I can afford it, or I have the ability to go to a park, but it's actually in my backyard, in my city. And so there are so many wonderful ideas and solutions that we just need to uncover, right? Because we've hidden them, or we've mm-hmm. destroyed them, yeah. Or we've erased them, and I think it's going to be. I'm very optimistic and hopeful that things are sort of cracking open through everything that's happened this year, and I think that figuring out what are those transformations that we can all sort of support going forward, as we know we have to have a reset after COVID. With the Black Lives Matter movement, I think, really listening to voices, and sort of, again, back to indigenous solutions.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. And I think you hit it as well when you were talking about, cancel culture. I think that, of course, there are some folks that just really need to get canceled. But I think that for the most part, it's really about shifting that to calling in. But one of the things I think that personally we need to all do before we, I don't want to say before we engage, we should always be engaging, but I think a really good personal practice is just honing in on, we all have different forms of fragility. And mm-hmm. I think that it's really what stops us from having deeper conversations. And I think that if I could say that there's one thing that we should all be really trying to unpack, is like, what are the things that like I'm personally a little fragile about? Right. And I think that that's a really important thing to explore. One of the hard pills to swallow more recently was, the results of this past election, which told us very loud and clear that the uproar of, white folks these past few months claiming solidarity and a desire to do the work ultimately was incredibly performative and really, fell short. And I think that, looking at the best way for people to get more involved and more engaged before having, at least a super clear set of action steps, is to just really have, on top of exploring your own fragility, which we can all just like, please accept that we all have forms of fragility, is to have discussions with like your fellow white peers specifically. Mm-hmm. I think that people want to come into BIPOC communities and feel safer having those conversations. Mm-hmm. But, the hard work is having, that conversation with your racist uncle or something like that. Talking about why intersectionality is an important lens to assess the framework of mm-hmm. our world and really the hidden curriculum of life that really exacerbates inclusion. I'll make one recommendation for folks,
yeah, please.
Vibing with this riff that I'm going on here. There is a TED Talk by Steve. I think you'll enjoy this as well. There's a TED Talk by Anthony Jock that I recommend, where he talks about access not being the same thing as inclusion. And the lens that he's approaching that is through the education system. So Steve, that can be your homework for the next podcast episode. But I would say really making sure that we're unpacking our own forms of fragility and then making an effort to explore those conversations with, the people in your family that might be the tough ones to have the conversation with.
That's
being in Texas and where you are, you're in the hotbed of what's going on right now. I mean, huge tensions. Any personal experiences you're having with that very tension and those conversations?
Yeah, you know, I think it's tough. I have, you know, here in Texas, I would say that even traveling around, it's difficult to kind of paint the picture of how unsettling it is to drive through the countryside and see, you know, Trump flags everywhere. And I think that people get very fragile about the demonization of a Trump supporter. Mm-hmm. But I think that what's really important for people to understand is that if you can put yourself in the shoes of not only just someone who's generally BIPOC, but somebody who is darker skinned, mm-hmm. I think that it's really important to understand that someone might feel that it's really unfair to demonize, say, just the simple notion of like a Trump flag. But given everything that's happening, I can only make surface level assumptions about who you are that have implications on my life. So mm-hmm. I think that that's, you know, especially more so if you are a Black man driving in the countryside of Texas. And mm-hmm. so, yeah, I think that that's kind of a form of, that's, I think, the largest form of fragility that I experience in Texas is people not wanting to be demonized to protect their own sense of self and identity, when in reality, I think that the more worthwhile nuance of the conversation is how freely and openly you associate with you associate yourself with something that makes me fear for my life. Yeah. And I think that that's how you take yourself outside of your own identity and not prioritize your own identity and really put yourself in the shoes of somebody who is so fearful of this symbolism for very apparent data-driven proven reason. So yeah, I would say that that's more so the fragility that I'm coming across in Texas for the most part.
Well, you know, I think we had this very conversation yesterday that people associate anyone who doesn't wear a mask is a Trump supporter. And so they automatically put that. And I happen to know, you know, this person was sort of claustrophobic and didn't wear masks about. Yeah. But that we're so fast to judgment and all of a sudden want no conversation and nothing to do and changing our entire attitudes by the mask. I mean, and we just assume that's a Trump flag. It's the same association.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that that's interesting. There, I think, are so many ways that we have been kind of trained to, yeah, like make fast, quick assumptions about folks. And I think that one thing that I'm learning to appreciate more, as annoying as assumptions can be on no matter what political party you're coming from, I think that what I'm learning to do is really appreciate that sometimes those assumptions are a survival tactic. And I think that just kind of being able to hold space for that while still just continuing to learn and educate myself is kind of where I've been trying my best to approach, seeing as how I am in Texas and I am around folks with a lot of different views.
Yeah. Well, and I think it is. It's biological. You know, we have to protect ourselves, and that's how we've, you know, over the years, we've learned that we have to make those quick decisions in order to protect ourselves, our family. Yeah. And that's why we classify things and want something to be put into a box. And mm-hmm. we want to, well, where do you stand? And it's, right. I think we do, it's hard to go back to go to gray because it's not clear. And then being in that can be scary. Mm-hmm. But I do think, just to circle back to symbols matter.
Yeah.
You know,
symbolism really matters.
Yeah. Symbols matter. And unfortunately, symbols have been, it's more than politicized because it's just, you know, it's just a challenge. And that's something that would be interesting to talk more about because I don't have the answers. But how do you bring people back together when they're really hiding behind symbols or hiding behind these things and don't want to have conversations. And it is, it's scary to have a conversation because you think you might say something wrong or, you know, you don't know enough, so you can't participate. And so how do we bring people together that it's okay? And I love that the hidden fragility you said was, that's a really beautiful line. I like that a lot.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, just like, again, reiterating that, like, we all have it, you know, we're all a little fragile about certain things. So just kind of unpacking that a little bit. And one thing, you know, for folks who are really wanting to have deeper conversations with like their problematic aunts or uncles or brothers or sisters or whoever, I think that one of the, you know, most successful methods that I have found as somebody who gets, you know, pulled into these conversations a lot is to really approach it from passion areas that the person you're speaking to has. So, you know, if you're uncle or you're just, I keep saying uncle, I'm like demonizing uncles right now.
You have a bad uncle? Do we know about? We don't know about?
No, not at all.
So, sorry, Uncle Charlie.
No. So I think that, you know, if you have a family member that you're wanting to have a deeper conversation with and they're really into, you know, maybe their glory days in high school was playing XYZ sport, or maybe they're really into photography, or maybe they're really into nature or climbing or just something specific. I think that it's so beautiful to challenge people to really explore social justice from, you know, their own lane. I think social justice, if there's anything that I've learned over the past few years, is that social justice hits every single lane. And I think that when you can really help empower people to be a better advocate within their own passion areas, that really, really helps.
Yeah. No, I love that. We talk a lot about local, you know, that sometimes you get so overwhelmed by the challenges out there, whether that's, you know, how do I help the planet or how do I help, you know, BIPOC? Okay. I'm like, I don't know. I'm just going to like stay home and just watch the Netflix. That, you know, if you can find your passion in local, you know, get involved locally, get involved with your local city council or your mayor, understand what the planning commission's doing, or your local school, you know, and, or just, you know, whatever, maybe spruce up your neighborhood, plant some flowers, you know? And so that can be a catalyst for more, that you know, you don't have to solve the world's problems.
Not at all.
And I think, and I'll just speak personally, you know, that in the past for me was just like overwhelming, you know, and, you know, my recycling or composting, I was like, is this even doing anything? You know, and so how do you, you know, find something local, grow your own community, and then who knows where that sparks and you know, blooms into something that's, you know, regional or national or global. But that's something that we talk a lot about, is like, you don't have to go, you know, I mean, we can vote, which we should all do, but like, it doesn't have to be solving this like world problem. You know, there's a ton of stuff going on in your backyard that can be, needs fixing. So
no, 100%. And I think I love that you brought up recycling, because I think that that's like the, you know, iconic staple of the environmentalist, right? It's like recycling. Yeah. And I think that when we find, you know, small modes of action within our own lives, one of the things that I hope our platform does, and just like the work of, you know, people that are trying to get more engaged with intersectional environmentalism in general, is that we really start to shift the narrative around what we are doing, but rather who we are doing it for, and really kind of lean into that mode of reciprocity. So, you know, rather than thinking about the efficiency of recycling and how we can make it better, of course, that's an important question to be asking, but who are we making it better for? And how can we identify who is being most negatively impacted by our trash, you know? So I think that just kind of asking, you know, those questions in a way that is more rooted in reciprocity rather than rooted in, you know, like Steve said, efficiency for the sake of efficiency.
I love it. I want to do a whole podcast on reciprocity. I can't even say it.
No, it's a new word for me as well. You know,
a great one.
Reciprocity. You'll definitely be saying it a lot after you read Braiding Sweetgrass.
I'm going to do that. Mm-hmm. Do you have any final topics or thoughts? I mean, you've been so many wonderful nuggets you've given us that you want to share, or you're starting your new podcast. Tell us about that.
So I guess I'll leave y'all with that. We're definitely going to be unpacking more of these conversations. My team intersectional environmentalist. We just launched a podcast called Dismantled.
Love it.
Yes. So go follow us on Apple or Spotify, whatever your preferred medium is. But yeah, we're really excited to, we just have such a robust, beautiful community of people who have been doing this work for so long across many different, you know, passion areas. And yeah, we're just really excited to like build a safe space to have those conversations.
Well, we thank you so, so much for taking the time to spend with us. This has been a delight.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This was exciting. And I can't wait to come back and visit when the world opens up a little bit more.
Open invitation. You let us know and we'll go walk in the woods.
Look forward to seeing you in person next time.
All right. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you.
Thank you, Monica.
Thank you for listening to Serenby Stories. New episodes are available on Mondays. Please rate and review the podcast and visit our website to learn more about upcoming guests, episodes, and everything Biophilia at serenbystories.com.